to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where educators go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top leaders across the globe. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Danny Sunshine Bauer.
This is episode number 113 with John David Mann, one of my favorite authors. Hi there, my name is Danny Sunshine Bauer. I'm a former classroom teacher and school administrator turned life and leadership coach. I'm also the host of this podcast where each week I share my conversation with top leaders across the globe to help you accelerate your leadership development. In today's show with John David Mann, we explore a number of interesting topics like go-givers versus go-getters. How to assume the best of your people, leadership lessons from Navy SEAL snipers, and the story of David starting his own school as a high school student. John David Mann wrote The Go-Giver Leader. He is one of my favorite authors, and this was such a pleasure to connect with him. Thanks for spending some time with me listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. Before we jump in the episode, I'd like to take some time to thank our show sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by CSC Consulting Group, whose venture is a social enterprise, and their vision is to catalyze sustainable change in our society, one organization at a time. Learn more at www.csconsultinggroup.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. I know the owner and founder of School Spirit Vending. He is a personal friend, and he brings hassle-free fundraising to your school. But even better, Matt has written a top 10 school fundraising ideas of 2017. He's given it away completely free. Get it at schoolzonepodcast.com. That's the top 10 school fundraising ideas of 2017 at schoolzonepodcast.com. Well, hey there, better leaders. I am so excited. I am absolutely thrilled to be here with you today. And now one of my favorite authors, John David Mann. He wrote an incredible book called The Go-Giver Leader. We read that book in the masterminds, and it was one of the favorites that everybody has read in the group. And so I shot for the moon, and I said, is there any way you'd be on this show? And he said yes. So here's his bio, and we're going to hop into the show. John David Mann is an award-winning author whose books have sold more than 2 million copies in more than a dozen languages, including the New York Times bestseller, The Red Circle, with former Navy SEAL sniper Brandon Webb, and the best-selling worldwide classic, The Go-Giver, with Bob Burke. His Take the Lead with Betsy Myers was named by Tom Peters in The Washington Post as Best Leadership Book of 2011. John performed his first composition, a musical score, Aeschylus' Prometheus Bound in Greece at the play's original venue when he was 13 and won the BMI Awards for Student Composers at 15. At 17, he spearheaded a group of students who founded their own high school and after graduating joined the faculty. He concertized on the cello before turning to careers as an entrepreneur and author. John, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
So we read The Go-Giver Leader in the Mastermind, and I'd like to start with just where did you get the idea for the tale?
So, of course, The Go-Giver came first, and my friend Bob Berg, I'd known Bob for many years. I'd edited his stuff, articles and magazines and even a book of his, and he approached me with this idea for a story that was based on this premise of like the go-getter, but the go-giver. The idea being that, not that there's anything wrong with being a go-giver, because go-givers get things done. We love go-givers, but the idea being that when you premise your actions on putting other people's interests kind of primary, then focusing on others rather than on yourself, it ends up being very profitable, not only noble, not only morally satisfying, not only nice, but also pragmatically effective. Like it's an effective way to be in the world, in whatever venue you're talking about, business, education, arts, et cetera. So we wrote The Go-Giver. It came out in 2008. It gained a huge following fairly quickly, and we were thrilled. We kind of took off from there. And I've always, so this is back to The Go-Giver Leader now. we came out with another book about sales, Go Give Her Sell More, which is Bob has his whole life been a sales trainer. I've always been fascinated with leadership. My dad was a choral conductor. My mom was a teacher. My dad was a college professor. And I've had inspiring models of leadership my whole life, both childhood and also in my business life as an entrepreneur. And I had, over the years, kind of developed these sort of what I consider my key principles about leadership. And I was just itching for a place to put them. And so we wrote this book, which our publisher gave the title, It's Not About You. And nobody bought it because it was called It's Not About You. So yeah. I guess people figure it's not about me. I guess I won't buy it.
Yeah.
After a couple of years of completely non-sales, we went back to our publisher and said, hey, we want to re-release this book with a different title and we want to rewrite it and make it one of the Go-Giver books. And we did. And it's called The Go-Giver Leader. And it's been done phenomenally well since we re-released it. So it's really a product of both Bob's life and my life and the early Go-Giver experience and just everything we both always wanted to say about leadership.
What's interesting about that tale and what I want to unpack for the listeners, and we're going to dig into the giving mindset versus the getting mindset, but you know what you just said at the end there too, you had a different title. It didn't sell, right?
Right, right.
And really, you just had to repackage it and put it out there because you know you had something special. So I think that's an important leadership lesson too, because sometimes – you know, you have a great idea, but the presentation is why it might not take wings, you know, and fly to where it's supposed to go. But if you understand your audience, you know how to talk to them, put it in their language so that they're ready to receive your message, it's going to go crazy if it's the right idea.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we were so fortunate that our publishers are wonderful, and it's an unusual thing to do, to take a book that didn't do that well, repackage it and republish it all over again, and they were magnificent. They went with the gag and it worked.
Well, they're happy about that now for sure too.
yeah, they're good.
So I'm curious, you know, you got that go-getter mindset and then the go-giver. Is there a way that you can switch your mindset? You know, growth mindset is very popular, and so we can teach old dogs new tricks. But what are some ways to move from a me first perspective to a people first perspective and really becoming a servant leader?
Yeah, you know, I think it's first, I think the first thing I'm going to say is that, contrary to how it might sound, it's not necessarily an either-or thing. And again, what I mean by that is being a go-getter is not in itself, you know, being ambitious, driving, aspirational, having a passion for going after things. The kind of person who gets things done, yeah, that's what I mean as a go-getter. That's great. So we're not putting that down or saying it's bad. But in terms of your question, how do you make that switch? And I think, you know, that's what we try to get at with the original book, The Go-Giver. And we try to get at with The Go-Giver Leader as well. It's, you know, it happens in little ways. It's the little things often add up to big differences because little habits, you know, tend to shape the way that your life unfolds. Putting other people first, you know, for me, for example, it manifests for me most vividly in my relationship with my wife. We've all got relationships. We've all got friendships. We've all got colleagueships. It's easy to, in the first book, The Go-Giver, there's a whole scene where this logic unfolds. It's really easy to start thinking about relationships in scorekeeping terms. It's like, hey, I did this for you. I think you should kind of do this for me. Honey, I did the dishes last night. I really think it's your turn to go fill the car with gas, you know, or what have you.
Absolutely.
And my observation is keeping score.
Right.
Isn't really an effective way of managing relationships. As one character in The Go-Giver says, I scratch your back, now you scratch mine. That's not being a friend. That's being a creditor. It's like keeping track of who owes who what.
Wow.
So the idea of simply putting the other person first without expectation of return, of putting people in your sights as your priority, looking out for others' interests first, without the expectation of how that's going to benefit you, ironically, that ends up benefiting you. I mean, and you can know that that's going to happen. It's like you tuck that in the back of your mind. You just don't have that in the front of your mind. And we're not saying, by the way, by go-giver, we're not saying that we want you to, or that you should be, you know, a martyr or self-sacrificing or self-effacing, or, you know, it's not about feeling that you're undeserving and that other people are better than you are. Not at all. You're very deserving. You're wholly deserving. If you weren't deserving, you wouldn't have been put here in the first place. It's not about putting yourself down, and it's not about self-effacement. It's about simply putting your focus on how can I add value to the world around me? How can I add value to this person sitting across from me? How can I add value to this person that I'm interacting with? Make that my focus, trusting that if I do that effectively, I'm going to get taken care of. And that's going to happen in the marketplace. That's going to happen in the relationship. That's going to happen in the career building and so forth.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Once you start focusing on other people, it's like truly, truly focusing, zooming in on what they need and taking yes. care of them. Like you said, everything kind of falls into place. I used to be pretty selfish, and I would get upset. My feelings would get hurt. I'd take things personally. And at some point, I guess I woke up. And when I started thinking more about my students, when I then moved into administrative, started thinking about the staff, things stopped bothering me as much as they used to a point where, like, some of my, you know, current staff, they kept asking me, like, how are you so calm? You know? And it's yeah. it's because I'm not taking, like, even if people are mad at me, it's not, most of the time, it's not really even mad at me. It might yeah. be the initiative. It might be something that happened 3 years ago. And so since I'm focused on them, like, it allows me to let it just roll off my shoulders, you know?
Yes. Yes. You know, you can really understand why we called that book, It's Not About You, originally.
Absolutely. I mean, I would have bought it.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah. But that's okay. And we were talking about, like, giving and focusing, and how do I add value to others?
Yeah.
And that's so key too, because I think it starts to establish trust. And if you think about, you know, your character, Ben, and he hops in to the company there, they're like, who are you? You know, who are you that we should hand yes. over the reins to our right. company that we've built, that it feels like family? It's a small group, but by focusing on them, he started to build that trust. You know, what do you have for us leaders that are new? Maybe we're transitioning, moving into a new school, and we need to build trust with folks. How do we do that?
Yeah, that's so such a great question, because it is so key. And I mean, I love what you said about Ben in the story. It isn't like he sits down and says, okay, how can I make these people trust me? What happens is he just starts to take the focus off himself and his problem, and to really get to know these people. And in the course of doing that, that builds trust. Now, of course, in the story, it happens in the course of a week. And and actually, that's not as unrealistic as it might sound, because human dynamics can happen quickly. But ultimately, you know, obviously, trust is something you only build over time, some length of time, and repetition and consistency of character. I think one of the first steps in building other people's trust is to give them trust. Give what it is you're looking for is generally a good guideline, whether you're looking for love or looking for money or looking for trust. So if you want to build trust in a new community, a new school, for example, or a new community of some kind, if you show your trust, you act on your trust. You don't want to obviously be foolish or naive in doing that. I acknowledge that the world is, you know, can be a scary and difficult place. But to the best of your judgment, to act on trust, to share your trust, to give your trust, it's going to build sort of a trust bubble around you.
Yeah.
That people will like. People want to mm-hmm. feel that. I'm drawn to
the trust yeah. bubble. That sounds great. You know, John, there was a really neat quote. You said, you can lead only as far as you grow, and you will yeah. grow only as far as you let yourself. What yeah. are some things that you do for yourself to keep yourself sharp, and how do you grow as an encouragement to our listeners?
Oh, wow. That's you ask these great questions. It's funny. I always go back to my relationship because it's sort of like microcosm of my whole life. One of the things I've learned to do is, like you said something really good actually a few minutes ago about not taking things personally when people are mad at you or things happen to you or things happen in a situation that you're in. I think one of the great magnificent first steps is kind of to breathe, to stay calm, to not take it personally, to not assume that the world is out to get you or that this person is out to get you or whatever. I had a really good friend when I was a kid, and I remember telling him one day, we were both like, 12 or something, and he was kind of going on and on at night when I was asleep over at his house. He was telling me about how some person was almost like treating him badly. And I said to him something like, I think the best way to react is just to assume that it's not really about you, to assume that he doesn't mean anything bad about you. Assume the best of his motives. And in time, it's going to change how he is. I don't know where that came from, but I remember hearing myself saying, I got to remember that.
Yeah. That's good.
And I think that's really true. I think, one of the things that makes my relationship so strong with my wife is we both assume the best of each other. And son of a gun, it turns out to be true. But if we assumed the worst of each other, that would probably turn out to be true in time as well. It's kind of remarkable how malleable people are, even people that you are positive are out to sabotage you. Well, they might be, but it's you can only improve the situation by finding ways to think the best of them.
I like this podcast. I say it's for school leaders, right? And we do talk education, but I get interested on these tangential ideas. Yeah. But that's because it applies. Go-giver leader. You got Ben. I don't even know how to describe the corporation, but they acquire other companies, a furniture company, Allen Augustine. And what's that have to do with education? Well, you learn all these leadership principles. So yes. what you just said there, in terms of assuming the best, this is relationships. This is, how you relate to your wife. Great. We'll apply that to schools, but how do you do that? Is there something that it's some type of self-talk? Is there an exercise you all do? Like, how is it? Because at some point she's not going to do the dishes or she didn't, help out with the gas and you're frustrated and you're not thinking, she means the best by this, but you figured it out. So can you give us the secret?
Yeah. First of all, I think you're absolutely right. I think self-talk, I know people talk about self-talk a lot, but that's because it's worth talking about. Self-talk, you mentioned in the introduction that I wrote a New York Times bestseller with this former Navy SEAL sniper, Brandon Webb. Brandon and I have now done 4 books together. And when this interview is aired, we will have just come out with one. This August, we came out with a book called Total Focus, Applying Navy SEAL Principles to the Business World. It's just like applying leadership principles to the education world. True principles apply across the board. And one of the things that Brandon did with he not only was a sniper, he was tapped to revamp the whole SEAL sniper curriculum in the early 2000s and then to run it. So he taught a whole generation of snipers that included people like, Chris Kyle and Marcus Luttrell and people you've read about in bestsellers. Mm. One of the critical things he did was he brought into the course a whole system of what he calls mental management, a lot of which was positive reinforcement and self-talk. And it sounds like some airy-fairy, self-improvement seminar that you pay $1,000 for and do for a weekend and then forget for the rest of your life. Uh-uh. This is Navy SEAL snipers we're talking about
going into battle. Right? Yeah.
I mean, it is as pragmatic as it gets. So I am a huge believer and have been for decades in it's not just self-talk, but more importantly, it's self-noticing. It's like noticing what it is that you say to yourself, noticing the things you're saying, usually in your mind and silently, although I made a practice decades ago of vocalizing everything that I could find that was going on in my head. I would, when I was alone anyway. If you don't do it with others, then they'll think you're psychotic and put you away. But alone, I would vocalize what I was hearing in my mind, and I started hearing what was in there. I was like, "Oh, whoa! I'm thinking that." I think becoming aware of the things that you're saying to yourself about other people, about yourself, about your situation is hugely important, because you can't change it if you're not aware of it. And if you don't change it, it'll keep being the same. If it keeps being the same, you'll keep programming yourself to have the same pattern. So I think that what you said, the self-programming around what you're thinking about your colleagues in this environment is really, really crucial. There's another basic, I think, it's a relationship basic that it works equally well in a collegial situation, which is, okay, if there's a tension or a conflict in a situation, my response could be, how can I improve things for them? Yeah, maybe they hate me. Or yeah, maybe they're undermining me. Or yeah, maybe they're, you know, and maybe I'm in a situation that's so toxic that practically speaking, I just have to create insulation and keep myself separate from them. That does happen, and I acknowledge that. But in a lot of situations that are not quite at that toxic level, I can ask myself, okay, this is uncomfortable, this is awkward, this is even really, you know, has gotten negative in the extreme. What could I do to make their situation better? What could I do? What one thing could I do today to improve their situation? And it's not like if I do that, maybe they'll think about me differently, because then you're splitting your focus. Here's one of the secrets of the whole go-giver idea. You really can't focus on two things at once. You know, I always would say this in sales, because I used to be in sales too, and it's not my native culture, but I was in it for some years. And one of the things I taught my people was, if you sit down with a potential customer and say, how can I help this? What does this person want? What is this person after? What is this person thinking, needing, wanting right now? If I really put my focus on who is this person? What are they up to? What are they about? What's going on in their life? What is their situation right now? If I think about that hard enough, I am going to completely forget about myself. So I'm going to forget to be nervous about whether I'm saying the right thing. I'm going to forget to be nervous about whether I got my sales pat or down. I'm going to forget about, you know, the fact that I've got to make this commission or I won't be able to buy my kids food or, you know, whatever. I am going to forget myself, and that's good. Because if I can forget myself, then I can be my best self. I know this as a performing musician, you know, and a lot of this I learned in the world of music, because I spent, you know, my early years as a performing classical musician and composer. And when you're sitting in front of an audience of thousands of people, and you have you and your cello and a silent auditorium, if you're thinking, I wonder what I look like to them right now.
Oh boy.
It's over. Yeah. It's over. Just pack up the cello and go home. What you need to be thinking about is, what did Bach mean? Hmm. What was in Beethoven's heart? What was Shostakovich up to here? What's in this music? You know, you need to have your focus where your focus is. And if you do, it's not going to be anywhere else. The same thing is true with your cranky colleague. If you have your cranky colleague and you're thinking, what can I do to make this cranky colleague's life just 1% better today? Then you're not going to be thinking about how much they piss you off or how much they annoy you or how much it's unfair. We have a book called Go Givers Sell More, which, unlike the Go Giver and the Go-Giver Leader, and those are both stories that illustrate the principles in stories, which makes them very accessible. The Go-Giver sales book is not stories. It's not fiction. It's sort of like little mini essays on the principles of the Go-Giver in the context of sales. But in that, we added a couple of dozen little vignettes of real-life people that we know, and situations that they went through. And there were situations just like I just described, with the cranky person or whatever, the difficult colleague. And I think they're really instructive for people, even if you've got nothing to do with sales, because they're not really about sales. They're really about human interaction, which is, you know, everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of, I think, Daniel Pink's book, To Sell as Human or something.
It's
about, like, everybody's offering something to somebody, you know, and even if it's a educational initiative, you got to sell that idea. And so just figuring out, you know, how to relate with people and help them and really serve them. It needs to be a good idea, right? If it's going to work.
And by the way, I mean, and I know you and I were talking about this before the show, but this was never our plan or our intention. Bob and I wrote The Go-Giver for business people, basically, but it went into churches and marriage counselors and other places, and it has ended up in schools. There are a bunch of schools across the nation that are using The Go-Giver in their teaching curriculum. And it's so cool to see, because the idea of the Go-Giver in an educational context is the most fulfilling thing as an author that I can possibly imagine. So yeah, it's principles that work. If they're true principles, they're going to work everywhere.
And that's pretty neat. You know, we did mention that in the pre-chat. So can you share with the listeners a little bit, since there is that teacher edition, what does that do for the reader? How's it packaged? Like, how does it help?
Yeah, so the Go-Giver came out in 2008. In 2009, we heard from a teacher in Indiana, Randy Stelter, who was using the Go-Giver. He had done an experiment. He took the Go-Giver and he bought copies for every one of his senior class. And in the spring of that year...
I love this already. This is awesome.
Yeah, the spring of that year, he taught a little syllabus on the Go-Giver to his senior class. They all had to do a project at the end. It was so successful. He loved it so much that he did it again the following year. He's done it every year since. He's still doing it. When the Go-Giver Leader came out, he added that. What happened after 2010, 2011 was a few other teachers started hearing about this and asking Randy for his notes, if he would sort of copy that, and they started making up their own versions. And then we started hearing from a few college teachers, even a few grad teachers, a business school, a grad school out in Colorado, in California. And we finally decided, you know, this is happening. We should kind of pull it together. So Bob Berg and myself, two authors of The Go-Giver, and Randy, who devised his curriculum originally, the three of us got together and created a publication we call The Teacher's Guide to The Go-Giver, a curriculum for making a difference. And it's a little paperback, and you can buy it in paper or ebook. And what it is essentially, Daniel, it's a curriculum guide, lesson plan in detail. And it has how many? 7 lessons. So you could teach it in, you know, over 7 weeks or over 14 weeks, or you could teach it in a few weeks if you do one every day. However your lesson plans work out. People have used it in high school, junior high school, have adapted it for college use. And we're just, you know, we're hugely excited about it. It's on Amazon, you know, Teacher's Guide to the Go-Giver.
And all the books, you know, that we talk about, listeners are very familiar. We'll have that linked up for you in the show notes. And so you can just click through and grab all these resources. And I'm telling you, you need to pick up John's books. We read, the only one we've read in the group, the Mastermind, is The Go-Giver Leader. But people went bananas. They went crazy. They like most of the books. There was one that they didn't like so much. But this one, they went nuts over. They absolutely loved it.
I gotta tell you. Everyone who's listening to this, thank you so much. I have to tell you, Bob and I have done 3 Go-Giver books, plus the Teacher's Guide. We just finished the manuscript for a 4th, which won't be out until 2018. But the Leader of all of them is closest to my heart. I mean, there's a lot of my own life in that book, and it's a book that I personally care about a lot. So you are making me get all mushy saying the things you're saying.
We loved it. I'm just thrilled you're here. Like, yeah. I got to stop saying that so we can dig in more to the interview. But yeah. Today's podcast is brought to you by CSC Consulting Group, whose current portfolio includes individual schools, nonprofit organizations, small and large districts, and urban school systems. Their home city's in Chicago, but their work can be done anywhere in the nation, and they're actively looking for clients around the world. Find out more at www.cscconsultinggroup.com. Conferences, piles of flyers, getting stuck in endless email lists and never-ending calls. There's an easier way to sort through and identify the best school fundraisers. School Spirit Vending proudly presents the top 10 school fundraising ideas of 2017. It's a guide of the top fundraising companies hand-picked from the best podcast. As an added bonus, this guide lists 5 resource companies that would add tremendous value to your community, school, and students. The best part is that School Spirit Vending is giving the guide away completely free. Are you ready to simplify the search? Download the free guide at schoolzonepodcast.com. I have to ask this question for my guy Colin. He wanted to know: is Aunt Al, is she a real? Is she based on a real person?
I think she's becoming a real person. she is Pindar, who is the mentor in the first book and who is mentioned in the Go-Giver Leader, but he doesn't. He has a cameo. He was loosely based on a real person, who's Bob Proctor. loosely based on a real person. Aunt L is a composite of a number of people that we've known. So there is not one Aunt L, but the more we write about her, she appears in the next book too. She makes a surprise appearance. The more we write about her, the more I have a feeling that she's just going to one day like walk into my house and say, "Hi, I'm Aunt L." And I'm going to go, "Wow, you are real."
Yeah, you need to get a URL, you know, auntl.com. And
where are you? That's right.
That'd be great.
I got to tell you, There's a woman in the first book called Deborah Davenport who gives this speech about authenticity. And we were contacted about, I don't know, 5 months after the book came out by a woman in Arizona who said, "I work for a woman named Deborah Davenport, and she's just like you describe her in the book."
Whoa.
That's pretty freaky, man.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe Aunt L will show up. Who knows?
So this question might come out of left field for you, but, you know, with your classical training and performance and composing, is there a symphony, you know, that everyone should listen to that's listening right now?
A symphony. Wow.
The reason I ask, I used to, if you could picture 19, let's say 83, and I'm five years old, and I'm laying on the carpet with my dad and we're listening to records. We used to listen to classical music, and I became so familiar with those tunes when my mom brought me to my first movie, which was Fantasia. I was able to name all the songs while the movie theater was completely silent. And I would say, "That's Mozart. That's Beethoven." And so I'm just fascinated by classical and symphonic music. And I'm not an expert in it. And so when I get somebody on the show, which would be you, that is, I want to know what is something I need to listen to, but I'm asking it just for me. The listeners are going to get to hear the answer, though.
I'll just rattle off a couple pieces. But I've often asked myself the desert island question. If I could only have one piece of music and I was in a desert island, what would it be?
Yes.
And the answer is that it would be the Chaconne for solo violin by Bach, D minor. It's the last movement of his D minor violin sonata. But that piece to me is like the ultimate piece of music, Chaconne D minor. Symphonies, I would, to me, for some reason, Brahms' Third Symphony, it just always evokes, especially right toward the end, evokes something special that I relate to the Go-Giver leader. I don't know why. I only recently discovered Sibelius. Sibelius, where have you been all my life, man? One of the most famous Norwegians of all time. And Sibelius's Fifth Symphony, I blogged about it a couple months ago when I discovered it. There's something magnificent and life-affirming about that particular symphony. And I can go on and on about my favorite music because I'm a Bartok freak, I'm a Bach freak, I'm a Beethoven freak, I'm a Brahms freak. There's so much great, great music. I grew up with music and it's animated my whole life.
That's great. Offline, I'll get the spellings for all that stuff. I'll try to find it on Spotify for the listeners and we'll link that up as well. I'm curious, you said Brahms Third. Do you have any idea why that connects with you and the Go-Giver leader?
There's something about the way, you have to be patient to get to it, but something about the way the very beginning of the first movement comes back around at the very end of the last movement, but transformed. In the last, 60 seconds of the last movement, how it comes back in an incredibly peaceful transformation that kind of reminds me of the way both the Go-Giver book and the Go-Giver leader book somehow come around full circle in the end in unexpected ways.
I love it. That's awesome. I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to rein myself in. So Bob told me that you had some influence in starting a school. Can you tell the listeners about that experience?
Yes. First is when I was young, and by young I mean starting at the age of five, I went to a very small private school. I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up in a small private school in Jersey that was very arts focused and, kind of quirky in a way ahead of its time. And both my parents were artists. My father was, as I said, conductor, music professor. My mother was a pianist and music teacher. And so that was already in my household, but that school really nurtured a whole appreciation of the arts and also an appreciation of great education as a child. then I, you know, that school only went to eighth grade. I grew up, you know, and I went to another school, ninth grade, and 10th grade. I was in a public school and I wasn't loving it very much. It wasn't a great school. By 11th grade, I and a handful of my old classmates were so disaffected with the schools that we were in that we sat around one day and said to ourselves, hey, what would it be like if we had our own school? And we just started to fantasize about it. We started talking about it. Actually, I wasn't, to be fair, I wasn't in that first meeting. It was a couple of friends of mine who started saying, hey, we should start a school. And a friend of mine said, hey, you hear what these two are talking about? And we all got together and started chatting about it. And after a couple of weekends, we got serious, or we realized that we were serious. And my parents were, they just encouraged me and said, you know, keep talking, keep dreaming, keep thinking about it. And so we did. And we eventually went on and we created our own high school. One of the first things we did was to start interviewing directors because we realized that we needed a grown-up to do things like figure out what the heck we were doing, raise funds and find a building and understand how to make things actually happen. So we actually interviewed maybe half dozen candidates, all fascinating, talented people with amazing backgrounds, as our director. And we eventually hired somebody. I've blogged about this in my blog over the past year a little bit. We hired a wonderful man named Julian Thompson, who was also a novelist, who wrote some wonderful YA novels and still does. He came and he was our director, and we created a school. We went into operation in, 70. I forget what year it was. I'll think of that later and email it to you. But I went to it in its first year as a student, and then I graduated, and then I went back to it and joined the faculty. We had a small core faculty, and we went on and sent our graduates to places like Harvard and Yale, and then I went on to my career in music and moved away and lost touch. And then the school went on. The school went on for about a decade before it eventually closed and everybody moved on. But it was very successful for a handful of years.
That is absolutely fascinating. How many kids went to the school when it opened?
We had about 50 kids. We had about 50 kids. And, you know, one of the premises of the school was it was an alternative school. And the basic premise was it was a school by students, for students, so that students could study whatever they wanted to study, however much, however little. But it wasn't a place for kids to go drop out and hang out and do nothing. It was a place for kids to come and engage with their own education. So we created this program of volunteer courses, many of them taught by parents and members of the community. In one semester in that first year, at one point we had, I think, 51 students and 55 courses going on.
What? And it's awesome.
I was in charge of scheduling it, which I did on this gigantic piece of poster board. I had to figure out how to get every student into every class that they'd signed up for in a way that worked for a week and still keep one day free for me and my girlfriend. It was
unbelievable. You know, and this is like, this is amazing because currently it's so popular to talk about personalization and how to increase student ownership and doing these type of senior projects or genius hour type projects where kids really engage and own content that they're passionate about. And you guys were doing this back then and you started your own freaking school. It's not even a class. You started the school. That's amazing.
You know, I often, you know, the famous Mary Kay quote that says, "But you know, bumblebee can't fly physically, but it doesn't know that, so it flies anyway." That's kind of what we were. Mm. Our on my diploma was calligraphed. We all did each other's diplomas in calligraphy, and my best friend calligraphed my diploma with the motto, "We did not know what to expect upon the open road, but we began here." And my father looked at that and said, yeah, he said, in other words, we had no idea what the hell we were doing, but we did it anyway.
I love
that's
it.
That's basically it.
Leaders need to hear that, you know, and what your parents said to you, keep talking, keep thinking, keep dreaming. And this idea of the bumblebee not being able to fly, but it does anyway. That is a word for all the leaders today, because I know deep down there was some type of project, something that you came to this school that you're serving right now with, and you wanted to change everybody's life. That's how much you believed in that idea. And maybe you're pursuing it, or maybe you tucked it away and stored it away in the closet. But I'm encouraging you to pull it back out and like the bumblebee take flight and like John did, establish the school because it can be done. Believe in yourself.
I totally agree. And it doesn't have to be literally starting a new school like we did.
Right,
I mean,
it's,
you can, you know, really every school is being created all the time by the people who inhabit it. And, you know, and you can look at it, it's kind of like the economy in the world. You can look at the economy as, well, it's the system's rigged. It's stacked against me. There's nothing I can do. That's just a perspective I just don't buy. It's a perspective a lot of people have, but I just don't buy it. The same perspective says, I'm in the school system, this educational system. It's so structured. It's all like stacked against me. There's nothing I can do about it. That's just not how I see it. And I don't think it's how we need to see it, because the truth is, no matter what the structure is, and no matter what the parameters are that impinge from the outside, you're always creating it brand new every day, in big ways and small.
I have to ask this question, last question about the Go-Giver leader. It's just been burning inside me. You know, you have these ideas that are paradoxical to me.
Yes.
The less you say, the more influence you'll have, because the more you yield, the more power you have. And you talk about this idea, too, of pulling and not pushing, right? It's almost like this letting water go where it wants to, as opposed to trying to stop it, you know? So how does that work? By giving away power, you actually get more.
You know, you had a question in your question at one point. If it was one class we should add to our schools that isn't currently taught, what would it be?
Right.
First I thought entrepreneurship, and then I thought meditation, and then I thought Aikido. when I was a teenager, I was very strongly influenced by the writings of Taoism and Zen Buddhism. And I never got into it, you know, so heavily that I identified as a Taoist or a Buddhist or anything, but I was very strongly influenced by that thinking. And did a little bit of work in Aikido, very little. I was not at all accomplished, but I was very influenced by the philosophy and the thinking. I read Tao Te Ching a lot in various translations. And so this whole idea of pulling that you're talking about, you're right, it is like water. And, you know, as Lao Tzu says, the highest good is like water. There's something very very universal about that perspective to me. I've always really loved paradox and the truth that is to be found in the germ of paradox. That's in the first book as well as the second book. And in terms of pulling, you know, the more you give away, the more you have. That's how Aikido works. The way Aikido works is not by using force against your opponent. It's by using your opponent's force, letting that turn against themselves. It's sort of the Chinese idea of ancient Chinese idea of acting without acting. The way that I learned that in music was as a performer, as a solo performer, sometimes when you build to a climax in a composition, it can be much more effective. And this also works in public speaking. You can make a much more effective point by reaching to the pinnacle of the phrase, and instead of going loud, going suddenly soft. Understatement is often far more persuasive than overstatement. My father, as a conductor, has a very soft voice. I've played under conductors who have that kind of autocratic, tyrannical, sort of archetypal, I am the conductor, don't mess with me, image that you know you'd find popularized sometimes. In the same way, you'll find the same thing with a chef. I just wrote a book with a chef, and maybe we'll talk about that. But you see these chefs on television who are these absolute horrible tyrants, right? Like that's the classic executive chef who makes his sous chef cry, who makes the line cooks cry because he's so mean, because he's so exacting, because he has such high standards, because he's so after perfection. And conductors can be like that. My father was the opposite. My father was this gentle, sweet, unassuming man whose voice was so soft that you had to actually lean in to hear him in rehearsal. And I have sat in rehearsal. I've played under him quite often. And I've sat in rehearsals and seen the most cynical professional musicians who don't take no crap from nobody. And you know, who will just like go to the toughest conductor, just turn into butter in his hands. And it's not because he would push. It's not because he would scream. It's because, A, he really knew what he knew. He knew his subject down cold. no one knew classical music, like my dad, who grew up in Germany, went to the same, to a school that was founded by Martin Luther. I mean, this, he had his roots in that world.
Wow, yeah.
But also, he pulled. He was soft-spoken. He always understated. He always sort of asked rather than commanded. And it's, you could call it Socratic, because it is in a way. It has a strong, it has a strong DNA in the Socratic method, the whole idea of leadership by pulling. And I think that's, you know, that's the way great teachers teach. I think it's the way great leaders lead. They don't command. They are passionate about what they love, and they invite you to go with them.
And you mentioned the recipe, so I want to save time. Can you tell us about that new book that's coming out?
You are so kind. I'd love to. Sure. This is fun because, you know, you talk about starting a school. The Recipe is a book that I just came out with this October, and it's unique for me in two ways. The first is that it's another story like The Go-Giver. It's a little longer. It's a little more novelistic. A little bit, but it's still sort of a parable. It has seven principles that teach, you know, that it unveils in the course of the story. But the central character of the story is a 14-year-old boy. He's a kid who's just lost his dad, and he's in the course of losing his way. His grades are suffering. He's getting in fights. He's like, he's a kid whose life is kind of spiraling down the drain. And he, his life, his path happens to cross paths with that of a retired old chef. It's sort of like the Karate Kid meets Master Chef, you know? But the, so it's a very sweet story for me. It was my chef buddy, Chef Charles Carroll, who is an executive chef, who's a multiple gold medalist, Olympic gold medalist chef. Amazing, amazing man. He is the executive chef at one of the busiest country clubs in the nation in Houston, Texas. He and I wrote this book together, and the story idea was his idea, and I found it so touching. It's been a very moving thing to actually work on this book. But the other thing that makes it unique for me is, after I'd written it, my agent took it around New York to like 50 different publishers, and everybody loved it, and everybody said no. We didn't find one publisher who would publish it. They all said things like, eh, I loved it, but it doesn't fit our category, or it's not quite right for our catalog, or it covers sort of, we can't figure out what market it covers, because it covers, it's sort of about kids, but it's about cooking, but it's about personal development. Well, yes, it is. It's about all these things. And so what Charles and I decided was we're going to publish it ourselves. I've never really thrown myself into a self-publishing venture, a whole hog like this before. I've written over two dozen books, and they've all been published by publishers. So this is new for me. This is like starting my own high school. We create our own company. We self-publish this book, and you know, we aim to make it a huge bestseller ourselves without a New York publisher. We'll see how it goes.
What I love about that too, you know, and I can't wait to read it. Just like the school story, this is a great leadership lesson. Like, no is not a final answer. And,
right.
And I've, this is a mindset thing, but my mentor, you know, Aaron Walker, and this is how I got to know you and Bob Berg, is we read this in his mastermind, and I loved it so much over there. I said, gosh darn it, we got to do it with the school leader masterminds. But anyways, no means not yet. That's how he sees it. And, you know, I was talking to a few people, you know, just seeing if this service would be right for them, right? And the answer was no. And for a second, yes. I was like, gosh darn it. You know what I mean? It's starting to get down. And then I thought, you know what? I could learn from this, and I could find out why they said no, because maybe we can dig into the root and then address that.
Yes.
Or maybe it's just a not yet. It's the timing. And we could follow up in 6 months, a year, whatever. So that's a powerful leadership mindset shift that no.
Can I say something?
Absolutely. This is your show. Yeah. You're the star.
Can I say something else about that? That's so good what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it's it goes several ways too, because the first book, The Go-Giver itself, we wrote it in 2005. In 2006, my agent, who was my brand new agent at that point, I had not, it was our, you know, we were just newly collaborating at that time, took it to New York to publishers and got no after no after no after no. I have a blog post just about this because I forget the number, but I think we got 22 no's for The Go-Giver. We took it back and she said, you know, we could really work on this. And the truth is, Daniel, it wasn't ready. All the publishers who said no, they were right. It was not ready. Mm. We took that book, and my agent helped us and just tore the heck out of it. There was like red pen covering every page. We did a ton of editing, revising, simplifying, condensing. I learned a lot about writing in that experience. It took us about 9 months before we had the book, what we thought was ready again. She took it back to New York and got no, 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 and then finally a yes. But we would never have gotten it the first round. We didn't get it the first round, and it wasn't because they were blind. It was because our book wasn't ready. We took it back a second time. It was ready. We finally got a yes. I thought that was going to happen with this book too, and so I kept saying, oh, "Yeah, that's okay. 22 no's. The yeses are right around the corner." It wasn't. It never came. It never came. So this was kind of like a different experience of the same lesson for me. In the first case, we had to just be patient and we had to make ourselves better. And sometimes that's the answer. You know, when the thing doesn't work, it really is, I have to make myself better. I have to be a better actor. I have to be a better singer. I have to play the piece better. The audition didn't work. I have to just practice and just improve. I have to be my best. Sometimes it's just that the venue is wrong. It's like, this book is not going to get published in New York. It's going to get published right here on my desk. And that's just how it is. Fine. We start our own school. Fine, we'll publish our own book. Fine, we'll make our own restaurant. You know, that's sometimes the way that it works. I started my own publishing company, and it went bankrupt. It went out of business when I was in my 20s. That was a really tough lesson, but it was a good lesson because I grew out of that. It was an expensive and extremely painful failure. Not every experience that I've had with rejection has ended up with a literal triumph. I've had some things that really did go down the tubes and never worked. And that's part of it too.
Yep. But you kept on going, you know, and you pick yourself up and keep pushing and look at the impact you've had on the world as a result.
Too much good stuff out there to ever give up.
Okay, so I'd like to close, John, with just three sort of quick questions. Thank you so much for your time. What do you do for fun?
This is funny because my wife and I love to cook. And so writing this book with Chef Charles was a blast for me because I cooked everything in it. We love to cook together. That is fun for us. We love to shop. I never thought I would be saying this, but I love to go shopping with my wife.
For whatever, like clothes or whatever? Or
Well, particularly food.
Okay, grocery shopping. Grocery shopping. You love groceries? Yeah. Tell me I more. Know. My pretty partner, weird. She hates grocery shopping.
Pretty so. Weird, man. Well, my wife shops the way she likes. I love the way she shops. If it's for clothes, like she goes into the store and like, I want that. We go in and we get that and we're out of there. That's awesome.
that's pretty good.
We also love to walk. We take, we typically walk an hour a day. It's a time we get to unpack, unwind, talk to each other. And I love music. I've always loved music. And I'll tell you what is some of the most fun for me is reading. Weirdly enough, most of what I write is nonfiction. All of what I read is fiction. When I wrote The Go-Giver with Bob, I'd read like one parable. I think I'd read The 1 Minute Manager and that was it. I don't read the books I write. I read detective fiction, crime fiction. I read mysteries. I read, classic literature fiction, literary fiction, that is. I love to read. And people sometimes say, what's the secret to great writing? Great reading.
That's right. That's good, because I was actually going to ask you that question offline, but you already answered it, so it's okay.
Yeah.
If you could be automatically good at something, what would it be?
Can I say eternally youth?
Sure, I guess so. Yeah, figured it out.
I would like to be automatically good at eternal youth, but I think it's going to actually take some work. So I'm working on that.
And the last question, what message would you put on all school marquees across the globe if you could do that for one day?
Wow. It's funny. I spent some time at a college, High Point University. I don't know if you know this school. Can I take a 60-second diversion?
Yeah, of course.
So there's this college in High Point, North Carolina, called High Point University. And about 10 years ago, actually 12 years ago now, they hired a guy, an entrepreneur, to be their president. And I know this man. I had interviewed him before in the past, and I'd written with him. And after I interviewed him, his interview was so extraordinary. He's a wonderful teacher, entrepreneur, business teacher, success teacher, leadership teacher, and Nido Kubein, Q-U-B-E-I-N. After our interview, I remember saying, we should write a book together one day. Well, we are. We're writing a book together right now.
Yes.
We're writing the 10-year history of his first 10 years at High Point University. He transformed this place into such an extraordinary institution. And to me, it's like a model of education. And one of the things that he did was he created phenomenal messaging all around the campus. And just magnificent messaging around positive thinking and around a lot of the principles that you and I have been talking about, a lot of the principles of the Go-Giver and so forth. And so I'm struggling now to come up with wording for a marquee. Whatever it should be on the school marquee, it's probably there at High Point University. And you should go and visit and see it there. But I would put on, you know, something like, you know, something classic like, whatever the mind can conceive, you can achieve. Or, you know, one of those messages, you are responsible for your destiny. The greatest ideas in the world are still waiting for you to discover them. Things like that that imbue students with just the magnificence of possibility, because that's what I think schools are supposed to be for, is training students to look for possibility and also to learn and to develop the tools, the mental tools and personal tools, so that they can pursue those possibilities. They can extract them like iron ore out of the side of a mountain. They can extract, you know, the ore of magnificent possibilities out of the mountainside of everyday experience. I think that's what schools are for. And so whatever quote, I guess I would change the marquee every day, but whatever inspirational quotes from great men and women of history would remind students of their own. It's like Angela Myers always talks about how everyone is a genius. She starts every conversation with, "You are a genius." That's pretty sweet. You know, those are the kinds of messages I would tend to want to emblazon on the billboards where kids would see them.
Well, John, thank you so, so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Best way to reach me is my website. It's just johndavidmann.com, M-A-N-N, two N's. All my books are there. Descriptions of all my books are there. My blog is there, which is, you know, I have Twitter and Facebook and this and that, but really where I focus my energy is on that website, on that blog. So that's the place to reach me. And as far as parting words of advice, I mean, all I can say is just get better at the little things you do, and great things will fall in your lap.
Well, Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life's 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and John. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type John in the search bar, and the show notes page will pop up and get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. John, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
It is so my pleasure. Thank you, Daniel.
Better Leaders, just a few more things before you take off. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show. This helps gives the show some social proof, aka iTunes juice, and encourages new people to listen to the show. If you are a social media junkie, share your biggest takeaway from the show, and feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer. Take the letters, switch them around, and create something interesting and new. That's how I got it. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Do you want to get a short email from me every Sunday where I share the best resources I have come across, links to interesting articles, books, blogs, and podcasts that have challenged my thinking, and a quote that's inspired me and will inspire you as well? If you'd like access to this resource, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and join the newsletter at the top of the page. Over 1,000 school leaders subscribe, and I think you'll benefit from it too. In the newsletter, I also share when a new blog or podcast comes out, as well as different opportunities to work with me. Thanks again for listening to the show.